Summer's hotter weather is finally here, but don't let hair loss also make you sweat. Regrow hair with the help of Hims. They provide access to personalized treatments so you can see thicker, fuller hair in just 3 to 6 months. Yeah, 3 to 6 months. That's it, kids. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including chews, oral medications, serums, and sprays, doctor-trusted, clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil can stop hair loss and regrow your hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Get started from the comfort of your own home. Fill out an intake form, and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. The process is 100% online, which means getting started has never been more convenient. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Plus, treatment options start at $35 per month. Hims has helped hundreds of thousands of men get their confidence back with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at Hims.com/drinking bros. That is Hims.com/drinking bros for personalized hair loss treatment options. Hims.com/drinking bros. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hey, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. Build a customized renter's policy with American Family Insurance so you can protect your tandem bike on the go.
Thief!
Oh, he is struggling with that two-seater. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at amfam.com.
Some exclusions may apply. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
Life on the front lines requires you to step up your game. Owned and operated by former Navy SEAL Sean Mattson, CardoMax has designed just the right supplements for you and is offering Drinking Bros an exclusive offer. Buy one, get one free on your first order. Go to CardoMax.com and use the promo code DB. That's CardoMax.com, helping you achieve your max.
Hey, welcome to Drinking Bros, kids. I'm down, I think, to my last week in North Carolina. It appears as if the house will be repaired by June 1st. So I'll be back in the studio forever after that. This hopefully is my last Zoom call, D'Anthony. But in the meantime, we got two monster guests on today that I am unbelievably amped about because this has been the hottest topic in our office for months and months and months. We got Michael Heller and James Salzman. How are you guys?
Great to be here.
Yeah, where are you guys at today?
Michael?
I'm in New York City in Manhattan.
I am in Santa Barbara, California. We are coast to coast.
Wow, coast to coast. We're talking about NFTs today, kids. How many times, are you guys getting hit up with this question every single day of what is an NFT?
Let me explain it to you. You know what Bitcoin is? Bitcoin is fungible. It's like money. You can trade them. NFT stands for non-fungible token. So it's like a Bitcoin, but it's attached to a specific asset. That shot of Michael Jordan dunking the basketball that NBA Top Shot wants to sell, that NFT is attached to that particular, as you own, in a sense, up to a point, that particular image of Jordan dunking.
Got it. And when did this all get started? Because I feel like there's been a gold rush of this in the last sort of 18 months. But I'm sure it's probably like the internet where people have been working on this for years and years and years, and then it just got popular in the media.
No, you're right. It is brand new. It's actually newer than you think, and it's not like the gold rush. It's more like the tulip bulb mania. Like this is like a crazy mania that just sort of popped up. If you guys, if some of your listeners may remember like the craze for ICOs, initial coin offerings a couple of years ago, people sunk a lot of money into that before it all went poof. NFTs have a similar feel to them. You know, it might be the gold at the end of the rainbow, but it looks more like a tulip that'll like blossom into some, you know, pretty red flower and not be worth quite as much.
Is that your honest thought on this? Because, you know, right now we've had a bunch of guests on our show, athletes and whatnot, who are selling these NFTs at huge prices. We had one of the Gronkowskis on. His just sold for $1.2 million.
Yeah.
We've also gotten some calls for some other friends of ours. We won't say who they are because they're still in negotiations on those deals. But they're very big athletes, and they're looking to cash in on this. Is it smart for the athlete to take the money and run because you don't think this will be worth that much in the future?
That's exactly what they should be doing. Like, if someone's going to pay you $1 million for an NFT, take it. You know what we should do? We should do an NFT of this podcast and split this. Four of us, we'll split the million four ways. Because you know what? It's going to be worth zero in the years to come. I might be wrong. You know, it might be the pot of gold, but when you buy an NFT, you don't own the shot of Jordan dunking. You don't own the copyright. You don't own the right of publicity. What you own is a string of ones and zeros authenticating some other string of ones and zeros. This is, you know, this is the early days of a technology that may down the road be something quite valuable. But right now, what you have is a lot of people, you know, who are bored, tied up in their basements, stuck in the pandemic, who made a lot of money in Ethereum and Bitcoin like by accident, and they're trying to find someplace clever to park it.
I don't know if it's by accident. I mean, a lot of those people did it very intentionally first. And second, things are worth things are worth what we say they're worth, right?
Isn't that amazing? Like, that's like the secret of ownership.
It's very
like,
bizarre, yeah.
If you say it's worth something, yeah. Other people, like the key is to convince other people to believe you.
Yeah. Right.
The thing about NFTs is there's a lot of primary sales where you see like a lot of the original sale of that clip for 1.2 million. The time you'll know that it's an actual item of ownership that has some sustainable value is when you start to see what's called the secondary market, when you start to see resales. What I'm curious about and I'm so skeptical about is whether there'll be like real secondary markets, basically people buying used Beeples and used Michael Jordan shots.
And look, this is, again, this is why we wanted to have you on today. We literally called our publicist specifically and said, get us the NFT wizards to come on this show, because Drinking Bros is split up into a bunch of private groups on Facebook. One of them is finance, and a lot of people are trying to figure out what to do with Ethereum and Bitcoin and everything else, and they're going into these NFTs. And we said, look, I don't know enough about it. I'd like to get the experts on to discuss this, because that's what I thought. When you said it, was what's to stop someone from taking an image of, you know, Michael Jordan, since you said it, dunking from the free throw line off of what they found online, selling that NFT, but not owning the rights when it would probably be owned by the NBA?
Yeah, nothing is preventing you from doing that. Anyone can create an NFT of anything. So think about like old fashioned paintings, like ownership that sort of feels more tangible. Like there's one Mona Lisa, it's hanging in the Louvre. Like there it is. Everyone else does not own the Mona Lisa. They own a postcard. They have posters hanging in their rooms, but there's one original. For online art, it's a string of ones and zeros to begin with. So every image of that Michael Jordan doing that dunk is exactly the same. It's the same down to the pixel as every other image. Every image of the Beeple $69 million NFT is identical to every other image. There is no original. What an NFT is trying to do is to say, we're gonna like make up an original. We're gonna have the NFT, this string of ones and zeros, point to the string of ones and zeros that make up the digital art and say that one is the original. But that's an awful lot of faith that that blockchain will continue to exist and that it's pointing to something meaningful. Because once you've bought the NFT, you don't get the right to display the art. You don't get the right to basically show Michael Jordan's image. All you really have is the NFT itself, which may or may not continue to exist.
Man,
starting to sound a lot like fucking Beanie Babies, to be honest.
Yeah, Beanie Babies are great. Like, you have the Beanie Baby. It's like, you know, you can throw it at someone, you can put it in a box.
I don't know why the first place you went is throwing it at somebody.
That's the toddler in me.
You're the New York side, so you're the angry guy. The other guy's from Santa Barbara. He's probably a lot more relaxed over there right now.
He's a lot more chill. He actually, you look out of his window, you see the beach.
Yeah, James, how do you guys get along, and do you guys agree on this subject of NFTs?
Yeah, I think it's a tulip bubble. At least with tulip bubble, you get the bulb at the end. You can grow it, you can eat it, you can do what you want. And it basically is like folks just basically saying with our book, you know, we're going to print out 10,000 copies. One of them we're going to say is the chosen one. It's like Neo in the Matrix, right? Except it's not, right? It's basically just saying this book happens to be the one with the NFT. Now, it could be the greater fool theory, right? And so you'll be able to sell that to the next person. But Michael and I are both totally skeptical that there's going to be a real secondary market in these things.
Yeah,
that's why you want to. That's why you want a range of, you know, you want a range of views. It's like, you know, we have one set of views. When we do these shows, we often follow guests who have the opposite view. I was on Wharton Business Radio just before we were on with you guys, and their previous guest was like, "This is the, you know, this is the next sliced, you know, whatever grilled cheese, sliced bread, whatever some good thing is. That's a physical thing," and they're investing based on it. I think that's a reasonable gamble. I wouldn't put my money there just yet.
Sorry to interrupt, guys. I'm one of the producers here. So what you're saying is there's no application for the NFT right now. But as the generations get younger and younger and they're more digitally native, don't they find a need for digital assets and then for those to be verified?
Yeah, but the only thing that's non-fungible is the token, not the digital asset. That's the problem.
That's like the key.
So we have friends that have released their music albums on NFT now, right? That's fine, but with some pretty non-sophisticated software, I could steal that music still. There's nothing that anybody can do to stop me from doing that, right? So what is it? I guess, Georgia, what he's saying is the token's legit for sure, but it's pointing to something that has no real intrinsic value because, one, the value that it did have, uniqueness, is now gone.
Well, here's my example. Say a social media derived on the blockchain. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very popular. These things rise and fall overnight, where only NFTs can be displayed. You have a digital avatar, a digital home where your NFT collection can be displayed and be viewed by other people on that social media platform.
Yeah, but how do you get people to come there in the fucking first place? And why?
And you actually don't even have the underlying rights to display the NFT, because that might, you know, Michael Jordan can say, hey, that get your NFT, get my image off of your website. You can't commercialize the value of my persona. I own that. And he does. He has something called the right of publicity, which is a separate ownership right, completely apart from the NFT, completely apart from the copyright, which can block your display of it.
Yeah. And this, by the way, this recently just happened with Dog Man, the skateboarder with the cranberry juice.
Yeah, that's right.
He was skateboarding to the Fleetwood Mac song, and Fleetwood Mac said, look, you know, you can sell the NFT of this. You've got to take our song out of it. And then the Cranberry Juice Company said, you've got to blur our image out of it, which they did. And he's selling the original, you know, footage of it without the song and with the blurred cranberry image. And he was hoping to get $500,000. I'm not sure what he got for it. But
God bless him if he can get the $500,000. Now, for the song, you have, you know, you can have digital rights management. You can have DRM that protects people from downloading the song. That's totally different from the NFT. The NFT is an attempt to create some original ownership online for digital assets that are intrinsically copyable.
Mm. Okay, I mean, look at it from 30,000 feet, right? I mean, what the NFT does, I mean, ownership, you need two things for ownership to matter. You need scarcity and you need demand. The NFT creates scarcity. There's only one of whatever it is that's got the NFT. The question is, why is there demand? And that's going to be the real question going forward. Right now there is, right? Gronkowski's, you know, selling for 1.2. Is that going to continue?
Well, let me ask you this, because yesterday, Jay-Z entered the NFT world in $19 million he gave in funding for the platform Bitski, which is going into NFTs. That's a lot of money to dump into something that isn't necessarily real. So what do you tell somebody like a Jay-Z for investing $19 million into a company like that?
Well, you know, there's a lot of ways to turn a big fortune into a small fortune. Mm-hmm. And this may be one of them. You know, it's this is the bigger fool question is, you know, is there going to be someone following behind? The first people who get into anything like this, they're going to, you know, the first people who got into GameStop stock, they made a lot of money. Right. They as it sort of skyrocketed based on the Reddit sort of hyping. But the ones who come in later, sort of the average you and me guy, kind of guys who try to make money on this, we're going to get burned. So I don't think this is a terrible thing for the Jay-Z's, who have really savvy advisors who can get in early, who can be sort of the ones who get the sort of the leading edge of the wave. The rest of us are going to get sort of trapped in the foam, behind the wave, I think. We'll see.
Yeah, but if you can get out ahead of it, what would you recommend people to do? Because, you know, we've been approached by it. I own a bunch of my old movies. Some people have said, hey, sell your old movies on here. And then it's, you know, an NFT and it's one of one. What would you recommend for people to do right now? Just kind of sell everything?
Well, listen, if you have something to sell and you can cash out and you don't care about the future so much, great. But is it a viable sort of long-term market for artists, for songwriters, for athletes? You know, this may be the killer app from blockchain. I don't think it is. I don't think it is because you get so much less ownership than the NFT buzz has you believe. You don't own any of the underlying rights. What you own is an authentication mechanism, a specific string of ones and zeros attached to a specific platform that may or may not continue to exist, you know, tomorrow.
Now, I have one more question. Sorry, Ross.
It's fine.
People releasing his artwork, he releases one of one on some pieces, and some pieces he releases up to 100 at a different valuation. Now, him being the digital artist of that, it's the same as having a copy of the Mona Lisa or a print of the Mona Lisa at your house that's worth nothing. It's nowhere near as worth the original Mona Lisa, sticking with that same analogy.
You're saying if you get it directly from the creator of the art.
Right. And I feel like you should only be able to do that. Like, if someone else is releasing NFTs on art or images that they don't own, how is no one suing for that at this point?
If you're wondering whether or not we've set up some kind of apparatus to police the fucking blockchain world, it doesn't exist. All right. And it's not going to for a very long time. There's too many fucking interests in there, and nobody knows. It's chaos. Nobody knows what's going on. So, yeah, there's no way to stop that from happening. Somebody gets a digital picture at the display of the original or something and turns it into that, then you're done.
But the original ownership of that still is tagged. It's still known that it came from people. You still know that it came from the artist. So can't we authenticate in some way that way as well?
I don't know.
Listen, I can create a new Beeple. I can create an NFT on the same Beeple and sell that. Mm-hmm. Anybody can.
Yeah.
There's no limit to the number of NFTs that can be created.
Right, but it's not coming from the original artist, so why would that have value? These have value because he spent the last 10 years releasing daily art for free, and then now people want to own some of the artwork that he's releasing for purchase.
They don't own the artwork. They just own the statement. They own the statement that he says, I'm giving you a string of ones and zeros attaching to that artwork.
You don't own
the artwork.
He creates
the artwork. Anybody can go download the artwork. Mm.
Right, in the same way that anyone can buy a print of the Mona Lisa.
Yeah, but the original Mona Lisa is a very different thing. The original Mona Lisa has a texture and a quality and a feel and specificity that doesn't exist for online art.
I paint an exact replica of the Mona Lisa with exact texture, for purpose of the example.
Yeah, I mean, we use that with our law students as, you know, the kind of hypotheticals. You have the perfect exact, but you know, for tangible physical stuff, you don't. There is still one thing that was the original. And you just don't have that part of what's so appealing historically about the online, about the digital art community is that it was one of our most sort of democratic, open forms of art that we had created in the last century. What NFTs are trying to do is basically create a mechanism for speculation around art that sort of does to online art what that kind of speculative frenzy has done for, you know, the existing art.
Well, I mean, world. Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying, but I'm going to counter with something that's a relatively recent example of this working, and then that is the certificate of authenticity with sports memorabilia, especially.
Yeah.
Meaningless piece of paper that only refers to the actual object, and it became increasingly valuable during the baseball card wars and the signature wars back in the fucking late 80s and early 90s. It was the ability to authenticate that in any way, but all it did was give more value to something that already existed, right? So I think everybody's getting a little too smart for their own good. They're trying to figure out new ways to do this or do that. The same old stuff is probably what's going to be simply amplified by this new tech. It's not going to be some new thing, I don't think. And to be honest, I don't know what it is. I don't see any value in NFT, frankly. At least as far as, unless it's something like Giorgio's saying right now, which is that, when I say value, I mean intrinsic value. If it's something that a super fan wanted from somebody and they knew that only that. So if you take a picture specifically for that, right, maybe that matters to people. I don't know.
What if you get some sort of certificate with your NFT? Does that now give it value because it has does tangible? There's only 10 of those certificates printed with 10 NFTs?
No, like, it's not. It's because what he's saying is because a replication of this book right here, right, like the physical book, would be one thing. But I can literally right-click and download this picture I'm looking at right now, and it's the exact same thing. Like, it's a clone. So where is the value in that? Like, if somebody can steal it that easily, where's the value? And this is why everybody had – this is why Napster went away. Like, there was no way to assign value to these transfers. So I don't know what the solution to that is, or what, if anything, NFT tech will be able to transfer or secure. Maybe it's messages we're securing. Maybe we're encrypting information that changes hands for some purpose other than retail economy. You know what I mean? Who knows?
Look, NFTs might be the real deal. Like, you know, people thought that about ICOs, but about initial coin offerings a few years ago, and it didn't turn out to be. NFTs, you know, they may be. And they may be for exactly the reason you just said, which is this notion of, it's like the piece of paper that authenticates the trading card. But this sort of, it's so removed from the piece of paper and the card. Like, it's a string of ones and zeros about the art itself, which is perfectly replicable. And then it's a string of ones and zeros about the blockchain, which itself is a technology that it seems to me is a technology in search of its killer app.
Yeah, yeah.
And its killer app may well be smart contracts down the road.
Maybe.
That we can authenticate. But I don't know if the NFT version has, like, reached us to the promised land of the sort of killer app.
Well, I think I think the NFT itself, if anything happens, I think it would be the killer app. It's you would have to view it only on that platform. It would be something that maybe you can take a screen, or like you can take a picture with your fucking camera phone or some shit, but it is on some kind of secure platform that you cannot remove that media from anyway, record it. I mean, there's a number of apps that do that now. There's ways around some of them, but Spotify, for example, if you try to screen record with their Spotify podcast up and it's playing video, it will not allow you to screen record. There's all kinds of tech involved in that stuff. So if you could do something like that, but it would again, it would have to be only that piece of digital material would only be viewable on that app. You would have to have that app and that token. You'd have to have both things handshaking to be able to view or witness it or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, I mean, that may well be coming, but we're not. That's not what we have today.
Yeah, it's not what you have today. And then James, in your new book, Mine, here, you talk about the explosion of the baseball cards in the 1950s. And this is kind of what it feels like now. However, I would rather own an original Honus Wagner or something like that in my hand. That is one of, you know, 100 versus some digital artwork that I would have a hard time proving in the future.
Actually, part of our answers on NFTs actually goes back to the baseball cards in the 50s. So when baseball cards in the 50s had the same problem that NFTs have today, which is that there was no scarcity, that when Bowman Card Company printed baseball cards in the 50s, Topps said, hey, listen, we can do the same thing. We can just print baseball cards of the same characters. And Bowman said, hold on a second, we have exclusive contracts with all these baseball players. And Topps said, we don't care. We can just make our own cards. Like, you have, there's no right to the image of these baseball players. We can profit from the baseball cards just like you can. And they went to war. Topps and Bowman went to war, and actually Bowman won. The courts in New York created a new form of ownership called the right of publicity, the right to be able to commercialize the value of your image, which is what, you know, Marilyn Monroe and, you know, Lou Gehrig, you know, eventually potentially make their money on. But Topps actually then bought Bowman. Bowman won the law. Topps actually won the war because they bought out Bowman, and then they had a monopoly on baseball cards for the next 40 years until the late 70s. But that monopoly was based on a much more powerful property right than is what underlies NFTs. It was based on law. NFTs are outside of the law. They're not based on law at all. They're based on technology. Technology is very powerful, but it's not law. And I wouldn't count on it operating the same way that copyright, a traditional property right, or the right of publicity, a new property right that emerged in the context of baseball cards in the 50s, but a property right that became part of law, gives you a lot more secure status for pushing back against copiers of various sorts.
You know who's going to get rich off this is the lawyers.
Because the lawyers always get rich off of it. Like,
what's the news with that?
Yeah, they're going to be battling this out for years. I remember when one of the Kardashians went through this on Instagram, where they used an image from Getty that was taken of them. You know, paparazzi took a picture of them at an event. They put it up on their own Instagram, and it had the Getty imprint on it. And then I believe it was Getty tried to sue them for saying, hey, your picture got 100,000 likes, and we took the picture. And she was like, well, look, that's me. I didn't give you permission to take the picture. Why can't I use a picture of myself? If you're going to sell a picture of myself, I didn't give you permission for you to take my picture and sell it. I feel like we're kind of in the same ballpark here. And again, there is no law to establish that. There will be soon, probably. But it seems to me like in the end, the lawyers will get rich. And then whoever is able to monetize this as quickly as possible will make a little bit of money in the short term, but in the long run, it won't be worth that much. That's what it feels like to me. Is that accurate to you?
That's, you know, it's not a question of accurate. It's like a question of like, this is like gambling, or, you know, it's a fad, and it may well be that it's, you know, a fad that becomes a baseball card industry that actually has some staying power, or it may be a fad like the beanie, you know, the Beanie Boo industry, that where the, you know, where the money fades. I'm skeptical, you know, but you know, every podcast that we're on around this, you know, we're one end of the views, and there's other people who are hyping it and saying, hey, this is the next, the next big thing.
Well, the beauty of us is, you know, we wanted to have you on just out of curiosity, because yeah, we don't actually know either way. I know, you know, all of our producers that work for us are heavily into this, but they were also heavily into crypto before Dan and I were on this show. And now we look like the dummies because crypto has exploded and everybody's buying houses and Lambos and all the other shit. And we got into
and
it
NFTs.
Late.
And NFTs. And NFTs. That's where they're spending the crypto. It's like, you know, buying the game, the top shot. Listen, it's also possible that we're dinosaurs. Like, you know, your producer asked a little bit earlier, like, hey, young digital natives, like, this is what they want to own. They want to own, like, you know, first it was skateboarding a generation ago, and, you know, it's not skateboarding today. Today it's like online assets, avatars and currency. And that may well be right. Like, it may well be that there's a whole new world of ownership, and that world is, you know, we who are, you know, the experts are going to be disrupted by the kids.
For sure.
The kids are going to say, you know, screw you. Experts are wrong.
That's the demand side for sure. That's the marketing equation all filled out. But the supply side is still weird. There's still no way to authenticate that's the only one of that exists.
People can sell us, you know, a second NFT of the $69 million. Mm-hmm. Image. He can sell 100 of them. There's no legal mechanism that constrains the ability to create NFTs.
Well, then becomes the editions of baseball cards, because you can always go back to the blockchain and see which one was first, which one was original. So if he does release more, all that does to me is make that initial
right for sure. But some people have to value the fact that that's the only original one.
Right, and we already value digital art. And I want to point towards: did anyone see the digital skin boon coming for your video game characters? How much money people were going to dump into digitally clothing their characters? Sometimes even in first-person games where you don't even get to see it yourself. It's only for the other people in the game to see it for you. And
it's a big market in Fortnite and a bunch of other games, but especially that one.
World of Warcraft really put it on
the whole skins market is huge. And basically there's a lot of value being created in an online environment. But those online environments are always those markets are created within a sort of protected ecosystem, which is the Epic Games or, you know, whoever basically creates and controls or World of Warcraft, whoever controls that game, creates the in-game economy. Mm. And it usually takes a cut of it and also usually has some control over the shape and direction of that online in-game digital assets, which is not really possible in the NFT world.
Well, I mean, maybe the NFT sits on top of that platform then and acts like that, but that's not nearly as valuable as it would be if it was an independent platform, right?
That it was
a self-licking ice cream cone at that point. But yeah, here's what I think is that a lot of people who are moving shady money around are having a real easy time doing it right now. That's the first place my head goes. Anybody that's trying to launder money right now, it takes like 20 minutes. You don't even have to know a guy.
You know, you can just be the guy. Yeah. That's ridiculous. You used to need to use the Cayman Islands to go launder money. And then the Isle of Man and Guernsey Islands. There was like, you know, there was like a hierarchy for money launderers. And then like then South Dakota actually got in on the game. It turns out like if you want to launder money today, like the absolutely hottest money laundering haven in the world today is in the U.S. South Dakota is actually crushing Switzerland and the Cayman Islands. They've created more secrecy and more responsibility evasion, more tax evasion in South Dakota than you can get from your Swiss account anymore.
Yeah, where at and why?
How do you get there?
It's not. Yeah, but why South Dakota specifically?
Because in America, ownership isn't federal law; it's state law. It's not in the Constitution. So who owns what in America is based on state law. And so the most deviant states, state like South Dakota, can say screw you to the rest of America, and they've done that. What they basically said is, you know, park your money in South Dakota. You don't have to even come visit here. You don't have to sign papers here. You can do it remotely. But if your money passes through South Dakota trusts, you can structure it so that you don't basically, if you hit someone with your car, you don't have to pay them. If you owe money for child support, you don't have to pay it. It's outrageous, but it's become the place where hot money in the world goes to. And they've also cut out a lot of the middlemen on money laundering, basically just bring it straight to South Dakota. It's become the largest money haven, one of the largest money havens in the world just in the last few decades.
I mean, this is not unique.
Yeah, schedule a call with our lawyer for South Dakota, please. That would be great.
You guys don't qualify. Like for the South Dakota Trust to work, you would already know about them if you're rich enough. These aren't for the 1%. This is for the 1% of the 1%. You have to be at the $50 or $100 million net worth. Maybe you are.
Are you outing us? Are you saying we're not that?
You might well be. You're sitting on so much Ethereum and your NFTs that basically you could cash it out into like actual card hold cash. So then if you do that, when you're basically cashing out your $50 million, the place to do is to stash it in South Dakota. It is outrageous. There's actually most people don't even realize it's not like a metaphorically different legal system. If you're super rich in this country, like the 1% of the 1%, there is an actually different legal system in states like South Dakota that let you hide your money from all sorts of taxes and responsibility.
James, why does nobody else know about this? Yeah, James, why does nobody else know about this?
Well, as Michael said, because you're not rich enough. You don't have the advisors who are telling you. I'm sorry, maybe you are, but we're not.
I'm not.
Well, the real reason.
Have you ever wondered why when you were paying a credit card, you used to do it by mail, you would always send it to Delaware or to South Dakota? This is not a new thing. States compete with one another to attract business. So South Dakota, Michael, 20, 30 years ago, they basically lifted the limits on interest rates. The credit card companies could charge. No surprise, credit card companies set up offices in South Dakota. And this is the same kind of thing, but now they're catering basically to the trust and estates lawyers and the super wealthy. I mean, they crush the Cayman Islands. Think about that for a minute.
Yeah, you're right. Now, looking back at it, most of my credit card statements and all that stuff went to South Dakota or Delaware. I know, you know, our LLC for our company is set up in Delaware. And that was a fancy lawyer who did that for us and was like, hey, you got to go to Delaware. I didn't know why, but I went along with it. I wanted to ask you guys about this. With all the success of NFTs and everything else, the biggest surprise to me is the actual sales of arts and baseball cards, hard copies, that are still going around. Like even Basquiat this morning, that was a $93.1 million sale. Is one feeding into the other, or is one driving the other because they would rather have a physical copy of something?
Listen, when you hear kids on the playground fighting over something, they're shouting, mine, mine. They're usually fighting over
your book,
a toy, or our book. Or your, you know, a download of your pod, you know, or a CD of your podcast. They're fighting over a piece of food. They're fighting over some physical, tangible thing. Like when psychologists do studies of kids on playground, they're never fighting over a joke or a song. Like kids' brains are wired. Our human brains are wired around hard physical stuff. Different areas of the brain light up when you hold a mug from when you say, this is my song. Like intangible stuff doesn't feel like ownership. It's part of why property law is really different. Like who owns what? Tangible stuff, physical stuff is really different from intellectual property law. copyright law, patent law, the stuff that we're talking, NFTs that we're talking about today. Our brains, our primitive animal brains, are like wired for hard physical stuff. It's partly that, which is why I'm so skeptical of NFTs, because they're like, you know, removed from reality squared. Like digital stuff has a reality, and the NFT is like a reality, is like a layer on top of that own intangible stuff. And you layer that on top, you're so far from the primitive human ability. Like if you can't explain it to a five-year-old how ownership works, you got to be a little bit worried. Like I teach a bunch of law students how to be lawyers. And at the end of my semester, what I tell them is, if you can't explain it to a five-year-old, you haven't done your job. Like five-year-olds are like super sophisticated about ownership. Like they know this is my toy truck and I can go zoom, zoom, zoom. And if I throw it at my sister, I'll get taken away from me. Like they know like how ownership basically works. If your parent says, you got to give it to your sister for a few minutes, it's still mine. But if I give it to my sister for the rest of the morning, it's not mine anymore. They have a pretty subtle understanding of ownership. And NFTs are so far from that. When it gets to the point where you can explain an NFT to a kid, that's when I'll believe this is a real market.
Are you teaching copyright law currently? To your students?
I'm grading the exams. Like this is like a great relief from the hardest part of being a professor. The only really bad part of like the greatest job in the world is grading exams.
where are you professor at, by the way?
I teach at Columbia Law School in New York City.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, it's one of those little podunk place.
Don't lie, your TA grades all those exams.
Yeah, exactly. I want to shift gears here into crypto because look, a lot of these NFTs are purchased through Ethereum and things like that and Bitcoin. You don't obviously have a high opinion or a high long game for NFTs. What about Ethereum and Bitcoin?
Jim?
No, I mean, I think this is kind of what philosophers call the existence proof, which is it's there, right? I mean, this is what we were talking about earlier. You know, for ownership to be meaningful, you need scarcity. Any demand, right? Those huge sort of data farms that are just pumping out the algorithms to create these cryptocurrencies, you've got the scarcity there, right? Mm-hmm. The question is, are people going to want it? And Michael and I guess you all also were saying that's ridiculous, right? No one's going to want a string of ones and zeros. So far, we're wrong. And this is basically turning into a track record where you can, you know, you go to the bank to a certain extent, as people are. I mean, one of the things that I find so interesting about this moment in time is that we are moving really from this notion where evolutionarily and historically we own something, we own some thing, to really we have access to ones and zeros. That's all a cryptocurrency is. As Michael said, we're not wired to do that. I think it's one of the reasons cryptocurrency is so hard for, you know, folks like us to get our arms around. You know, cryptocurrencies are real scarcity. And if folks basically say, yeah, you know, that's something that I want, and there are more folks that want it that can get it, then it's going to continue. And so I would say I've been proven wrong on crypto. I thought it was just going to be a flash in the pan.
So are you guys in it now?
But that said, there are a lot of cryptos that haven't made it.
Correct, right. But are you guys in any of it now? As investors,
I invest in real estate. I invest in stuff that I can like understand, you know. And that's actually, you know, that's what this, you know, all the guru guides tell you to do: invest in stuff you understand. And it may just be that I'm a dinosaur and I'm investing in like dinosaur stuff, like real estate. But that's where I feel comfortable. I understand how cash flows work. I understand like what it takes to make a profit. I understand. I can evaluate the people and the technologies that they're using. Are they renting it out or not? And that makes sense to me. Crypto, you know, God bless. I just need to get to my own retirement. you know, it may well be that my students all retire on their crypto earnings. I'd be a little surprised if that's true. I mean, the great wealth builder in America for the last 150, 200, almost all of American history of like, how do you actually build long-term wealth in America? It's almost all through real estate. Real estate is how most Americans have most of their wealth. The 30-year mortgage means you put a little bit of cash down and the bank slowly, you know, buys the house for you over the time of the mortgage. Most people's retirement savings are the equity, the wealth that they've stashed in their homes. You know, there's a lot of 401ks, retirement plans, pensions, and so on. But the bulk of wealth in America still today is in individually owned real estate.
Well, now I'll flip it on you. A lot of people are buying real estate in crypto. Case in point, a friend of Dan and I's bought an entire office building in Bitcoin and was able to convert his cryptocurrency into actual physical real estate. MasterCard is now accepting it. PayPal is now accepting it. Dan, you've said this forever on the show that, you know, money is just a made up thing, and it's kind of wherever or whoever you can trick into believing that it's worth something, that it is actually worth something. Is it? And who's to say that it's wrong?
When MasterCard says we'll accept Bitcoin, that goes actually circles us back to the very start of our conversation today about like when are NFTs real? Mm-hmm. When do I begin to believe in them a little as having some staying power? When MasterCard is buying Bitcoin, what they're doing is they're saying that we believe that there's a secondary market in Bitcoin. They hold the Bitcoin for an instant and then they flip it onto somebody else and get back cash. So they believe that there's a deep enough secondary market where Bitcoins can be traded, that they will have a stable value over time, but they can begin to sort of evaluate Bitcoin vis-a-vis other kinds of investments. What's unusual about NFTs, as opposed to cryptocurrency, fungible tokens, Bitcoins, is that that there has emerged a secondary market, a trading market that has some depth and robustness in some cryptocurrencies, which gives me some more confidence in that.
That was what I said when
I start to see that in NFTs, when I see the used Beeples being sold and resold, and they begin to be a robust secondary market, that's when you begin to say, hey, this thing has some staying power.
Okay, so
go ahead.
I'm sorry. So in NFTs, like they're made to be resold. They're made to be traded. They want to be retraded because then the original owner of the NFT and the original buyer gets a piece of that, from my understanding. And that's why some people I've talked to have looked into it for concert tickets and other tickets, because they want to incentivize the trading amongst the NFT between people. But back to crypto real quick. Right now, we're basically paying for math. We're paying for validation of a transaction. And we're paying for validation of funds. And Bitcoin right now, it gets a lot of heat because its technology is bad. It costs more energy to validate that transaction with a computer to solve that math. And that energy costs money to produce from whatever power company you're buying from. And that's why mining Bitcoin isn't always fundable in certain places. And that's why you need to do it in places with low temperature. You don't have to pay to decrease or remove the heat from the room. And that's why the newer cryptocurrencies with better math better math, are rising up, and why people are building upon the Ethereum blockchain, because its technology is better and is more efficient. So that kind of makes sense to me, in a sense of like we have to pay to make sure something is validated, and it costs energy or computer energy basically per se to do that. And that makes more sense to me than like the market, in a way.
Hey guys, we got some sponsors who put this shit wagon on the air. First and foremost is ghostbed.com/drinking bros. Talk to Rich today. I talked to him about 10 minutes before we got on the show, actually. Trying to get the new mattress. Fake Dan, I told you, we don't get him for free, bro. We got to use our own promo codes. You got to go to ghostbed.com/drinking bros. They're too good. The mattresses are too good at ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. 30% off everything in the entire store, and you get free pillows when you order the mattress. And I can promise you this, the pillows are just as good as the goddamn mattress. They're the absolute best. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros today. As always, you got a 36-month pay-as-you-go program, no interest there at ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. And you can bundle those deals together and get all your sheets and pillows and adjustable bases, all of the things for a very, very low price every month with no interest for 36 months. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros today and cash in on a damn deals. Next up, we got, what do we got here today on the old show? BespokePost.com. It's boxofawesome.com. BespokePost is the ones that make Box of Awesome. Everybody keeps asking, like, hey, man, who makes these boxes? It's Bespoke Post. They're too nice. They're almost too nice for your show. I don't understand what's going on here. Well, that's because boxofawesome.com is Bespoke Post. And it's an easier way of saying what you're actually getting in the box. You are just getting a box full of awesome in there every single time. So when you sign up on your first box, use the promo code Drinking Bros for 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up today, and it's like $45. That's it. Your wife has makeup subscriptions and all that other shit. This is for you. This is for the dudes. You get something cool every month. You never know what it is. Could be a mixer set. Could be a bar set. Could be dop kit. Could be a machete. They got all kinds of cool stuff. I just got a full fajita set. My wife was amped about it. She was like, yo, did you do a whole fajita set? I was like, yes. It's just a bunch of cool stuff for dudes that you would never buy for yourself that is super high end. And you need it. Just go to boxofawesome.com today. Use the promo code Drinking Bros for 20% off your first order. And you're good to go on that. Each box only costs $45. It's got over like $70 worth of gear in it. Get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up for boxofawesome.com. Enter the code Drinking Bros at checkout. It's boxofawesome.com. Promo code Drinking Bros for 20% off your first box. Now we've got, as the sun rises, it dawns on him. I had to. You guys have your book on the show today. I thought I would give mine a shout out as well. D'Anthony and I are in the audiobook. Audiobook is starting to surpass hardback and paperback now. I will say this. Everybody wants to listen to audiobooks. I get why you guys are doing it. As the Sun Rises, It Dawns on Him is out now. D'Anthony plays a 55-year-old Asian man in that, and an African parrot, a rare African parrot. And it's part of the St. James Street James series and the romance novels for dudes. You start with A Night She Cries While He Rides His Steed, pop on in, and when darkness falls, he doesn't catch it, and then get the latest edition that just came out, As the Sun Rises, It Dawns on Him. Go to Audible. Use a free credit. I don't even give a shit. It counts as money towards me. It's almost like crypto. It's great. It just goes into our account. We love it. Thank you so much. Yeah, you know, the stock market.
I mean, it is. It's all voodoo, right? It's and money is voodoo. So the advantage of money is that it's backed. It's backed by a government that you believe has some staying power, and the value of currencies trading against each other depends on sort of the faith in that government's policies tomorrow.
But that's a relatively new thing with currency, yeah, though, right? The faith in the government. It used to be faith in some shiny rock we dug out of the ground.
Yeah. So it's been an evolution from the most physical, tangible media for value, which was, you know, cowrie shells in some cultures and, mm-hmm, you know, shiny metals that we dig up in others. But there was something against which we measure value.
It's still shiny metals. Those shiny earth minerals are used to build the GPUs and CPUs to process this information. It's still shiny metals that we need to dig out of the ground.
Yeah, that's true. It's decoupled from the sort of guarantee, which, you know, you may not believe in, but, you know, the governments provide a guarantee behind money that was the transition from you know, fiat currency, from currency based on gold, to sort of currency just backed by the promise of the Federal Reserve.
Right.
And with cryptocurrencies, it's backed by, you know, it's backed by nothing. It's sufficiently outside of the law that it answers the money laundering hope of sort of a lot of dark money around the world, the place to be, the perfect place to hide that money. But it also has the vulnerability of being outside of the law.
Man, it's so tough to say what is correct and what isn't. I love the debate between different generations, in particular Giorgio. I know how passionate he is about crypto and NFTs and all this stuff. But, you know, I look at a guy like the managing director at Goldman Sachs yesterday from the London office, who quit his job after 15 years because he made so much money in Dogecoin. So you definitely can make a ton of money and get out of it, I guess. You know, to compare it to your gambling statement earlier, It just depends on when you get your chips off the table before everybody figures it out. And it's such a strange world.
Chips are the right thing to say, right? What are those chips worth? A lot of plastic,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the window going to be there when you go to cash them in?
Yeah, it seems like NFT is basically speculation at this point. It's a speculative market, and the speculation is, or the supposition rather, is this is going to be valuable at some point in the future, right? And that's where we get into the secondary market.
Yeah,
when the 48ers went out to California to go get gold,
like right. They knew that if they actually got the old out of the ground, like they were speculators, but they like, you know, gold actually had some worth.
Right.
That's not so clear for the NFTs that there is actually some hard valuable thing there.
Well, maybe
at the end of the day, that's going to have worth tomorrow.
Maybe people are conflating the value that cryptocurrency now clearly has, right? Because Visa is accepting it. I mean, Tesla, a number of large companies, PayPal is processing it. Maybe they're conflating the two, right? NFT, to be clear, is not a currency. It's not something that has any kind of value in that way.
No, and that's by design. Like, that's the N in FT. Like, it's right. The non-fungible piece of it. That's the core that for this new application. It's an application that is still in search of an underlying sort of notion of ownership that connects to something that, you know, here's the thing. Giorgio may make NFTs real because of his belief. It's his faith. He is a zealot. He is a convert. And if there's enough Giorgios out there, then they create their own reality by trading amongst themselves. And that may be all it takes.
You know what's weird is in real life, there's enough Giorgios out there that create their own reality that I don't even know if coins matter in his world. And I'm amped about that. what made you want to write this book in the first place? This mind book. Why?
Yeah, so Michael and I had both written popular books earlier. I wrote one about drinking water. He wrote one about certain aspects of ownership, why it's hard to get people together to do things. And we were looking for a new topic. And a friend of mine said, you know, it's funny, no one's ever written Freakonomics for how we own things. And if you look at Freakonomics, I know, I'm sure that you know about it.
Yeah.
Basically, if you look at it as a writer, essentially, it is taking very clever stories to teach pretty simple microeconomics. And if you understand basic incentives, you know why sumo wrestlers cheat and why drug dealers live with their mother, right? It makes you feel smarter after reading it. we do the same thing with ownership, right? It turns out that how ownership works, they're just six simple stories that explain everything. And we try to use clever, engaging stories to sort of bring you in. And, you know, after you've read Freakonomics, you look for individual incentives. After you've read our book, you look at the different ways we own things. And once you start looking at how we own things, then the world just snaps into focus. And you start asking the kinds of questions that we've been talking about on the show so far.
Yeah, I think if you're a musician out there and or somebody that creates stuff that gets licensed in any kind of way, you really should take a look at this book. If you're a person that owns property, you should probably take a look. There's a number of people. Maybe just if you're alive, take a look.
Yeah, if you don't own property, you should understand why you don't. Like, that's a choice that someone else has made for them to own it and you not to.
Right.
And it comes back to our simple stories.
Yeah, it does. And like, you know, we have a lot of listeners out there right now who are looking to invest their money in different places. I think a book like this helps because right now it's confusing. The world is muddied. I mean, you look what happened with the Robin Hood thing for GameStop and for obviously AMC, where they were able to just shut down the market. You know, Dan and I had gone on air and just said, look, it's how do you trust the stock market after that? If you're able just to turn off the game over and over and over again, if something is driving through the roof, I tend to agree with you where I think real estate will always be real estate. And, you know, in particular, near an ocean or something like that.
But not too near because oceans are rising. You want to be a little bit back. Get too close, you're going to get flooded.
Yeah, that's true. It happened to me once and I lost a house in that. So you might be right on that. But I'm with you. Look, real estate and land in particular.
Not making more of it.
Yeah. No, they're not making any more of it. I know Oprah's famous saying is God, you know, God's not making any more beaches. And then there's a reason why Bill Gates is buying up. What is he? Isn't he the largest landowner in the United States now?
He's it used to be Ted Turner. Largest landowner in America, where he Ted Turner had these huge ranches. Mm-hmm. Now it's and bigger even than these big Texas ranches. You know, out in Montana and Wyoming, enormous amounts of land.
Not to be
actually,
troll,
you know, a lot of really, but you know, if you want to know some of the secrets of the super rich, it's not just that they stash their money in South Dakota, but they buy farmland in Saskatchewan. They're buying farmland in these Canadian, remote Canadian provinces. On the their long term play is. These will all be temperate farming communities down the road, and they want to get in ahead of the while they're still not farmable.
Ah, a lot of celebrities were doing that in Los Angeles, getting together, buying up a lot of farmland in the Midwest for marijuana harvesting, actually.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of reasons that lands. Listen, I'm not a big shill for land or real estate. Now, that's just, you know, like, for me, what seems most important is for your listeners who are thinking about where to park all these, you know, Bitcoin profits is invest in what you understand. If you think you understand Bitcoin, you know, God bless you. That should be where you're going. I don't, so I don't invest there. You know, but you know, if you're in tech savvy, there's a lot of fortunes to be made today in the tech world. But invest in what you have some confidence you understand.
Yeah, I've been investing a lot in weed and pills, actually.
That's the future. You know, I remember, you know, watched that TV show Weeds with Jenji Cohen from a couple of years ago.
Oh yeah,
that was a great show. And when that show ended, like that was like it ended, this last season was like 5 or 6 years ago. The end of the show, these guys were like on the run from the law for the whole show. Mary Louise Parker, the last episode, this fantasy episode of the future was like pot cafes with different, you know, pot on, you know, on display like a Starbucks.
Yep.
And it seemed like insanely fanciful to think that could be the world. And that is the world today. Like, that is the future. Like that is, it's becoming a huge and growing business. So listen, if you have some hot, you know, hot tips on where to invest, let me know.
I wouldn't.
What about you? What about you, James? Where's your money at?
My money is sending kids to school.
You don't get to invest it at all? All your kids are in college?
Yeah, grad school. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll really eat it up. What if you tell me where grad school it is? I'll know that you'll be broke for the rest of your life. Then is it Columbia?
Wharton.
Oh, even worse. Good luck. Yeah. Yeah. You're going to be poor forever after that. I hope this book does really, really well. Well, how did you make your money growing up, James?
I worked for Ali's General Store. I remember going the first day, I was like 15 or 16. And I said, how much are you going to pay me? Because I thought that, you know, and he'd say, what's minimum wage? And
so that was it.
Great job.
No kidding. What about you, Mike?
My first jobs after college, and my jobs in college, I waited tables all through college. I loved waiting tables. My favorite job was waiting tables. You're standing up, you're interacting with people. It's like, you know, right away if you did a good job, like you either get 20% tip or you don't. I love the immediate feedback of that. After college, I was a typist for a couple of years. I was a temp typist, my first job. After
Oof,
college.
That's a brutal one.
That was a terrible job.
That's a horrible job.
But it paid pretty well. I don't know.
Well, when you were coming up, you know, like growing up on the come up, and you were looking at investing and all that other stuff, who did you look up to understand kind of the financial system and the market in order for you to do the things you are? And the other thing we always get is from our audience is, did you have a year in mind of like, all right, I want to retire at 65 and here is my plan and I'm going to set this forth?
So I've always tried to have a job where I don't want to retire.
Mm.
You know, I love what I do. And I won't say they're going to take me out in a box. But, you know, I'd say, you know, if I weren't doing this, I kind of like to share ideas with smart, you know, sort of edgy folks like you and be able to sort of, you know, to talk about that. In terms of sort of where I got financial guidance, it's always been sort of folks who are older who seem to know what the heck they're talking about. And just talk to a lot of different people. And as Michael said, try to understand what they're doing. Because this stuff is not, no one is born understanding the stock market.
I actually teach, I have a class that I teach my students. I'm supposed to be teaching them property law. But I take one class and I say, the class today is like, the class is called How to Be a Grown-Up. And it's like just the basic things you need to know. Like, what kind of insurance do you need to have as a grown-up? I ask them, like, how many of you guys have umbrella insurance? And like 3 hands go up out of 100. Everyone should. But it's just like basic stuff like that where like the stuff that someone should teach you, that no one does, but how to like be a grown-up in our society. I try to give some of that to my students. I learned that sort of slowly, painfully. I made a lot of mistakes, you know, investing early on. I learned from my dad, who was a pretty careful, patient investor. And I, like Jim and like most faculty, found a job. And this was like, it took me a long time to find teaching as a profession, as a, being, being a law professor in particular, like where I'm surrounded by smart people. It's basically a part-time job. The actual job part of it is a couple hours a week. And you spend the rest of your time thinking about, talking about stuff, writing about stuff that you care about. So it's a job from which I wouldn't want to retire. Actually, and this has been conversation that you have in the faculty lounge. Like, if you won $100 million in lottery, like, how would you change your life? Like, I wouldn't change my life if I won $100 million. I wouldn't quit my job. I wouldn't not teach. I love teaching. I would teach a little bit less, but I would still teach. The one thing that I was like, what would I do differently is I would have fresh flowers on my desk every day. I would like, if money were no object, I'd always have like someone bringing me fresh flowers so my desk looked nice.
I would be teaching and in would, some kind of super
I would fly first class. So I don't have to wrap people reclining their seat into my knees.
Yeah. I would spend all the money buying an Iron Man suit, like a real one that functioned, and I would show up to everywhere I went in that thing for the rest of my life.
I would love that. See, I need to go for you for my fantasy life. Yeah. Like my fantasy life, I'm not thinking big enough.
No, you're not.
All right, I'm throwing, toss the flowers out. I'm going with the Iron Man.
Well, add weed and pills, and you'll start coming up with these ideas on a more regular basis.
World's
listen,
best
this
drugs.
Is good. This is where Drinking Brothers can really make a contribution.
Yeah.
Is like,
oh, yeah.
What should our lives look like when we got the $100 million?
Oh, I can paint it for you. How old were you when you got married?
I was in 44. I was old.
Okay, so you're 44. How long you guys been married now?
15 years.
Okay, 15 years. So if you're super rich and want $100 million, obviously you're going to want to scale down, probably hit that 24-year-old. You know, go back in time.
Right, the trophy wife. I hear you.
Yes.
I love my wife. I don't want to trade her. I'm pretty So I'll take that under advisement.
I understand that, but you start there, okay?
Right there. All right.
And then start with all of the drugs you never really did and the parties you never really got to go to. Because, you know, with enough money like that, you can actually buy your way into anything. And that is a total serious statement. There was a bet with a friend of mine who had made a ton of money off this movie in Hollywood. And he goes, I bet you $5,000 that I can take a picture with Barack Obama within a month. And it was when he was running, and I was like, there's no fucking way. Yes, he bought his way into a fundraiser, and I took the photo. He shook Barack Obama's hand, and he gives me this like shit eating grin of like, I'm telling you, when you're rich, you can do anything you want, and it's totally true. And when you see all these pictures with like Epstein partying with Bill Gates and all this other shit, you're like, oh yeah, fuck. Only the rich hang out with the rich, and you can do all this other wild shit. But yeah. Marry young, do a lot of drugs. There was a great story of a kid who went to go try to kill himself in Mexico, emptied out his bank accounts, bought all the drugs and prostitutes he possibly could in Mexico. And then at the end of it, when he ran out of money, he realized, oh, shit, life is pretty fucking awesome. If I can just make enough money to do this all the time, I definitely don't want to kill myself. And I learned a lot from that. So I think the both of you guys, like if you didn't have to pay for grad school and you were flying first class and you were getting a private jet, James, I think you'd be a lot goddamn happier. And then, you know, then you could really start over and be the person you wanted to be, maybe.
I'm going to push back. I feel pretty – I have the wrong fantasies. You know, my fantasies are flowers and not the jetpack with a 24-year-old. But I'm – you know, one of the challenges of being a grown-up, I think, is finding the path that works for you. And I feel like it took a long time to get here. But being a law professor is like better than working for a living. It's better than being rich. It's like you're surrounded by smart people. You have to have conversations like this. It's like super fun. This is where it's at.
I'm with Michael, except for the better than being rich part. Better than being a law professor and
too rich. Yeah, because look, I always say the same thing. I'm like, you know, when people say money can't buy you happiness, I'm like, no, they're liars. It can. The only thing is you have to have a good set of friends in place already, and great family around you already. Because when you get there, you know, with this show, we've interviewed everybody that you possibly could. Oscar winners to porn stars, athletes, you name it.
And they all say the same thing, that their family comes and hits them up for money and everything else. The ones who are the most adjusted are the ones who were or came from great families, had great relationships with their wives or their spouses and things like that. And then they had great friends in place before it happened. The ones that are absolute nightmare scenarios, I'm not going to say who they were because I've worked with a lot of them, were the ones that didn't have any of that in place. And then they got all the money and then they got all the fame. And then they were like, oh, shit. What now? Like, people still don't like me.
Yeah, no, I live in a world, my wife is a television writer. We live in a world with a lot of people who are in the television industry who are, you know, the stars who aren't very happy are the ones who, you know, didn't have the kind of grounding from before they got famous. You know, they got famous too fast. They got, you know, they got famous when they were too young. And there was too much money and too much fame and they spin out of control. And it's terrible. You know, it's, actually, when you talk to psychologists about who actually study happiness, there's like a whole field of happiness studies. The happiness actually goes up. If you are poor, life sucks. And happiness goes up pretty steadily as wealth increases. But above about a surprisingly low number, happiness does not go up as you get wealthier. And that number turns out to be about $75,000 a year for an individual. So anything above that, there's very little correlation between wealth above $75,000 a year and self-reported measures of happiness and all of its correlates like depression, anxiety, drug use, whatever the inverse is of happiness, or not drug use, but like, you know, drug use that sort of interferes with your life. It's actually pretty, people get to a level of happiness at a lower amount of money than you might guess, according to psychologists who study this.
No, it makes sense. It makes sense. Not everybody's got dreams of you know, Lambos and.
I have these pathetic, you know, nice flowers in the desk dream. Like, don't pay me anything.
Yeah, I mean, shoot for the stars. That's a terrible one.
I hear you.
That's a terrible one. If you won the lottery, you just want fresh flowers.
I know. I gotta really rethink my priorities.
Yeah, you want some of that Peruvian marching powder there. Yeah, pure. None of that stepped on shit like Britney. Just some pure shit.
Yeah.
Since you guys wrote this book and you seem to be ahead of the time a little bit, what is the next thing around the corner that we should be looking for investment-wise, or what's the next NFT or crypto? What is that next thing that is around the bin that maybe we just don't know about quite yet?
You know, I got to say, in all honesty, asking two law professors that question shows a basic misunderstanding of where our expertise is.
There was a time when I was like, I made a series of bad choices on stock picking. And my friends started to say to me, listen, we need to know what you're investing. Like, they wanted to know, like, what are you investing in, Halle? What are you investing in? Like, why do you want to know? It's like, whatever you're investing in, we're going to short. Like, you're consistently bad. So, you know, whatever we tell you, you should short that future.
That's hilarious. So
I will say, I think we talked about this earlier. I think betting on climate change is a good bet.
Okay. As far as
it's going to happen. So buying the farmland in Canada is a good idea, is what he's saying.
Canada. French champagne producers are buying land in England.
Yeah.
Because that's where the champagne production is going to be. Yeah. Investing heavily in shoreline real estate for the long term, it's not a good place to be. I mean, we're seeing climate change happening in real time. So that actually, I mean, that's something I'd take into consideration.
That's interesting. Dan, you were talking about that New Orleans would be underwater here, you know, pretty soon.
50 to 100 years would be.
Yeah, you should, you know, there isn't an easy way to short cities, but if you could short stock in New Orleans and Miami, I would do that.
Yep.
Oh, Miami too, huh?
Oh, yeah. Miami is going to sink. Absolutely. It's basically, it doesn't have 50 years.
Oof. What about Battery Park?
Battery Park is also a challenge. You know, that is more salvageable because it's such a small contained area. But you know, there'll be another superstorm that will reveal how vulnerable it is, you know, sooner rather than later.
And so the name of the game that people don't talk about, actually, now that you mention, I actually know a lot about this.
There we go.
People don't talk about, I just don't make money off it, is what's called migration, right? Or retreat. So, you know, Miami Beach is going to be underwater. New Orleans is going to be underwater. Where are those people going to go?
Oh, okay. So the existing cities, are you talking about buying real estates in existing cities right outside of Miami and New Orleans?
For example,
where they go to.
You're seeing in Charleston, South Carolina, for example, cities are basically doing, it's called planned retreat, managed retreat. And in some areas, you're just not going to be able to defend and you go back.
No, it makes sense. There's a, we're Dan and I live in Texas, and there's a town there that's, what is it? Is it SpaceX, Dan, that's going to, and they're buying up all these shitty houses there?
Yeah. They were in the news last week when they launched, they landed this big Mars rocket back on the ground, and it, you know, breaks windows in all the little houses around it.
Brownsville, is that the name of it?
Yeah, that's it.
But they don't care. I mean, they're buying launch pads. I mean, they can move that anywhere.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's crazy. That's crazy. You guys were awesome. This is the point in the show we get to the drinking bro of the week, which is someone who has inspired you or helped you become the person you are today. We'll start with you, Michael. Who would you like to give the drinking bro of the week to?
Drinking bro of the week goes to a teacher and mentor of mine, Carol Rose. Like, she taught me that property was like cool, and that the law is overrated, and that you have to really understand what's happening on the ground and not these big fancy ideas. Everything we're talking about today comes out of work that she taught me as a law student many years ago.
That's awesome. And how about you, James?
Yeah, mine's not personal. It's my brother. It's been 10 years since he died of cancer. Think about him every day. He just, you know, had great sort of grace in dealing with a really sort of crushing turn of fortune.
Man, you're able to say that with a smile, which is crazy to me.
Well, you smile or you cry, so I choose to smile.
Man, that's great. And then the book, mine is out everywhere. Did you guys do the audiobook?
Audiobook is available. Download it on Kindle.
But yeah.
We didn't do this. We didn't talk it. Our publisher was like, "You guys, no, we're going to hire a professional."
No.
Is it the British guy? Is the British guy reading it?
Yeah, he's not a British guy. Actually, what's weird is the British edition has an American reader. It's a different reader for the British edition, but he's doing a British accent, although he's from New Jersey. We don't know why they hired him.
That's hilarious.
Hilarious, yeah.
Yeah.
We have the Vietnamese edition coming out as well. I don't know if that's going to have an audiobook. And the Thai and Romanian, a bunch of Ukrainian. Look for it in Odessa.
Yeah.
I got a quick question for you. I want to do a quick survey.
Fire away.
This is the U.S. cover.
Mm-hmm.
This is the U.K. cover. Whoops. Which do you prefer?
I would say the one on the right, simply because I'm in books. So if I'm in an airport, you grab the one on the right.
One on the right has a lock with the word mine. The American version has a slice of pie with a fork in it.
Correct. So the American version on my screen, it's the fork with a slice of pie.
That's the American version. That's the, like, pie is good. Everyone loves pie. Book's got pie on it. I'm going to buy the book.
Do you know why they did the lock, just out of curiosity, overseas?
We don't know. They had their own graphic artist design that, and they said, here's the design.
I have to tell you, one of the original version had these two hands pulling on each arm of a teddy bear. And it was like, how awful is that image? Because you know how it's going to end up.
Either way, the bear's going to lose his arms. There's weird shit overseas. With these movie posters that you know, we did, whenever you see the overseas version, depending upon what country it is, it's super wild. They would put like a machete in Danny Trejo's hands if his movie was doing well over there at the time. They would put some Asian was always way off the deep end, where it was just like
crazy. Guys, I have to run. Jim can stay, but I
no, 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 no. We're done here. We appreciate your time, and you guys were unbelievable. Check out the book Mine. It is available everywhere on Amazon and bookstores, and then the audiobook is available as well. Thank you for your time today, Michael A. Heller and James Salzman.
Pleasure.
Cheers.
Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you. And for Giorgio, D'Anthony Holloway, I'm Ross Patterson. This is the Drinking Bros. Good night, everyone.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. It happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.